Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Let's get our bearings as that deadly air battle between Israel and the militant Palestinian group Hamas in Gaza continues. Yesterday, Palestinians took to the streets in the West Bank and in Israel in a protest strike of support. Since this fighting began 10 days ago, Hamas has fired thousands of rockets into southern Israel, most of them intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome system. The Israeli military has unleashed an unrelenting campaign of heavier firepower onto Gaza. More than 50 Israeli warplanes pounded parts of the region overnight. About 12 Israelis and more than 200 Palestinians have been killed, according to the latest numbers. Both tolls include children. NPR's Daniel Estrin is in central Israel. Daniel, what's the status of the violence?
Well, today, as you mentioned, there was intense Israeli strikes, especially in southern Gaza Strip, and at least 6 Palestinians were killed in strikes, as well as an entire extended family that fled their home when they got warning from Israel about a strike on their home, and their home was completely destroyed. We've seen that throughout the latest 10 days of fighting. And rocket fire, of course, from Gaza continues, although a little less than previous days, that rocket fire continuing on to Israel.
Well, you heard from a senior military official in Israel. Israelis, we know, are saying they're targeting tunnels used by Hamas fighters. But what do they say to critics who say they're inflicting much more pain on civilians than seems necessary? They have a sophisticated system, but they've hit Gaza's only COVID testing center, water supplies. What did he say?
Right. We spoke with a very senior Israeli military official in a briefing with reporters, and he acknowledged the civilian casualties. He said that Israel does not like seeing women and children and ordinary civilians killed, and that in many cases, he said, the Israeli army calls families to warn them, sometimes even giving them 3 or 4 hours to evacuate their home before their home is bombed. However, he said that the lives of Israelis under fire are more important than the lives of Palestinians who live near, for instance, rocket launchers. He showed us aerial photographs of rocket launchers next to residential buildings and between buildings. In one case, a rocket launcher between 2 homes that he said launched a rocket and killed a young boy in Israel. He said, if the world condemns us, okay. We, Israel, he said, are upholding the international laws of war. And indeed, that is on top of people's minds because the International Criminal Court is investigating whether Israel and Hamas in Gaza have committed war crimes in past fighting.
Yeah. And what's the significance of the strike, the Palestinians who've taken to the street? It reminds those new to the region's story that there are Palestinians living in Israel in another territory, the West Bank. But what does it mean that this happened?
Well, we've been seeing tensions building, really, Robin, for more than a month, ever since the start of Ramadan. In Jerusalem, Palestinians said that they felt that the Israeli police were sending them a message that they are not wanted. Police were preventing Palestinians from gathering in an area they usually do on Ramadan, police saying that they were attempting crowd control. That escalated into confrontations between police and Palestinians at a holy site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, a very sacred site to Muslims and in Jewish tradition. And we've just seen this snowball where we've had confrontations with Palestinians and police with hundreds of Palestinians wounded. That escalated into tensions that led to the fighting that we see in Gaza and throughout not only the West Bank, the Israeli-occupied West Bank, but also inside Israel. As you've said, Palestinians staged a general strike, didn't go to work. You know, in West Jerusalem, where the predominantly Jewish side of the city, for instance, I saw restaurants that just weren't serving food because their Palestinian chefs weren't there. A pharmacy completely shut because their Palestinian pharmacists were at home. And it feels like it's a moment that Palestinians are standing up and uniting in this cause of defending what they say is defending Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Is there concern that what has been an air war might become some sort of a ground war? I mean, there have been attacks between the two groups, Arabs on Jews and Jews on Arabs. And we were hearing the phrase civil war whispered? Are there more concerns of those kinds of attacks?
I think that is what is particularly concerning Israeli citizens, both Jewish and Arab Palestinian, inside Israel. I'm in the city of Lod right now in central Israel, where it's the epicenter of this civil strife that we've seen between Jews and Arabs, stemming from so many tensions in Jerusalem, from potential evictions of Palestinians in an East Jerusalem neighborhood, from the Gaza fighting. We've seen synagogue, mosque torched here. And I was just visiting a synagogue that was torched and being restored. And Palestinian neighbors across the street saying, we were the ones who called the police to tell them about it. We want to live in coexistence and in peace. But there's a real unsettling feeling now. Very painful to see neighbors pleading for calm while, you know, a smaller number of protesters are talking about war.
And here's Daniel Estrin in Israel. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Attorney General in New York State, Letitia James, says she is actively investigating potential crimes in the Trump Organization, which is run by the former president's two eldest sons. Let's go over the details and the potential significance of this shift in the investigation. Andrea Bernstein is with our member station, WNYC. Andrea, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And do we know yet what crimes the New York Attorney General is investigating?
Well, not specifically, but we do know what the pattern of behavior is that she's been looking at. And that's because last fall, she requested that Eric Trump, the former president's son, come give a deposition. And he refused. And she went to court and he was ultimately ordered to testify. And a result of that, we know that she is looking into a pattern that ran through the Trump Organization of putting certain low values on properties when, say, it came time to pay taxes. But when it was to their financial benefit, they put much higher values on those same properties. And what they were looking at was whether New York taxes were underpaid. The fact that this has now crossed the threshold into the criminal arena strongly suggests that whatever questions they had about civil violations have been answered, and now they are asking themselves whether New York criminal laws were violated with regard to this overvaluation, undervaluation pattern.
Does it also suggest that Donald Trump could be exposed criminally?
So what the Attorney General's office said last night in a statement was that they were examining the Trump Organization. However, what we know is that the New York Attorney General's investigation is now happening in conjunction with a separate but very expansive criminal investigation by the Manhattan DA. And the Manhattan DA has said he is investigating Donald Trump, his associates, and his business for possible fraud and other violations of New York criminal law. So those two investigations, which have been happening on separate tracks, are now joined.
I see. Well, the former president's son, Eric Trump, who you've mentioned in response to a request for a comment about this from the Washington Post, sent the newspaper video clips of the Attorney General criticizing President Trump while she was campaigning for office in 2018. Let's listen to that.
I'm running for Attorney General because I will never be afraid to challenge this illegitimate president when our fundamental rights are at stake from the Muslim.
So basically here the Trump family is trying to paint this investigation as political. Do you think there's any merit to that?
Right. And I should say that the Trump family and the Trump Organization have denied all wrongdoing, although they didn't specifically respond to requests for comment about this new development. But what Donald Trump has argued in all of his legal proceedings around his taxes and around these investigations is that the prosecutors are politically motivated. Now, he's made those arguments in court, and they've been rejected by the courts up and down, or down and up to the Supreme Court twice. But that does appear to be their continued response, is that, excuse me, these are Democrats, and these Democrats are, if you will, out to get them.
Okay, so so you mentioned this investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance and how it is going parallel with the Attorney General's investigation here. How rare is that kind of cooperation? What might the significance of it be?
Yeah, it's pretty rare. In the past, these two offices have been sort of, you know, wary competitors circling each other. But this case, there's no other case like it. The DA in February got a hold of the tax returns, millions of pages of records. There's a sprawling international business. And we know, again, from what's been made public, that these two offices are looking at something similar. So it appears they've decided that it'll be much more efficient and that they can sort of pool their expertise in deciding whether crimes have been committed to join together. So the attorney general has tasked two assistant attorneys generals to the DA's office to further investigate this case now as one sort of larger unit.
Hmm. And just briefly, what do you think all this could mean for the former president?
Well, I think it's a significant escalation of the criminal stakes. There are now two open criminal investigations of the former president of the United States and his business practices. And these are investigations that have gone on for years, that are obviously quite serious, that have involved a lot of people power. And what prosecutors and former prosecutors have told me over and over is that the fact that this investigation has gone on so long yeah. and seems to only be intensifying suggests that the DAs are concluding.
Andrea Bernstein, thank you so much.
I want to share a story with you now that might take a second to set up. Many are already familiar with one of the most iconic photos in American history. It was taken on May 4th, 51 years ago. Yes, May 4th has become Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. But for many of us, it will always be the day that armed National Guardsmen were called to confront unarmed college students at a peaceful anti-Vietnam War protest at Kent State University in Ohio. And over 13 seconds, they fired 67 shots, grievously injuring 9 students, killing 4, including Jeffrey Miller. And kneeling over him in that photograph that's been called the Kent State Pietà, a 14-year-old runaway named Marianne Vecchio, her arms extended in anguish. We'll post the picture at herenow.org. But today, we have an update of sorts from Jeffrey Miller's older brother, Russ. Now, he can't get away from that Pietà photo that freezes his brother in time. But is it possible a new photo might bring some joy to those of us who knew Jeff? Yes, full disclosure, Jeff Miller was my brother John's best friend. His mother, Mrs. Miller, Elaine, was our indomitable high school secretary at John F. Kennedy High School in Plainview, Long Island, New York. Russ Miller, your mom, who passed recently, was a force of nature, was she not?
I have to agree with you. I'm very proud of my mom.
Yeah. When Jeffrey was killed, what a shock for all of you. I just can't imagine seeing, you know, a loved one, as Neil Young wrote in that song, Four Dead in Ohio, what if you knew her lying dead on the ground, and you knew him?
You know, my brother and I were very, very close, and you know, some people have never recovered from that day. Mm-hmm. Others, my mom especially, and I like to think myself, are positive people, and you find ways through it. It's as if, you know, somebody has stolen something from you. You know, you wonder what could have been. You know, who would Jeff have become? All those things are just big question marks. You know, it's when he was just trying to figure out what to make out of his life.
Yeah. There were three others on the cusp of becoming what they would become, Alison Krauss, Sandy Scheuer, William Schroeder. History looks on that picture with sympathy now. It's widely considered, you know, a warning about the foolishness of turning an armed force on unarmed citizens, on people's children. But as you know, Russ, at that time, there had been some unrest. An ROTC building downtown was burned. Now, later investigations, a government commission determined that the firing on students was completely unwarranted. And we'll link you to videos that show you what was going on. It was relatively tame when shots rang out. Yet, as you know, polls showed a huge swath of Americans blamed the students for their own deaths. Richard Nixon called them bums.
I'll tell you something that I don't think you've ever heard before, and that was that my own father did. My own father reacted just the way I would hope nobody would react. And I remember my mom received a lot of hate mail. A lot of people, you know, said stuff like Jeff deserved it, you know, and so it was really quite the shock.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, that split there between your parents. And it represented the split in so many families. It tore the country apart. It tore the country apart.
Most of the people were, it was totally positive. We knew who Jeff was. He was very intelligent. he even skipped a grade early on. He was just a nice kid. You know, we just, we ended up looking for the good in this whole thing. And there was a lot of good because it did signal a turning point for the country in that war. And that counts for a lot. So that's what we grab onto.
Yeah. Well, and you also grab onto other members of the community that gets formed, all the other families. A center was built at Kent. And 8 years ago, Sandy Scheuer, as we mentioned, one of those killed. I'd always thought she was just going to class, but her roommate, Janice Reinstein Stone, surfaces to say that she'd actually invited Sandy to go to the rally to meet up with Jeff. Because what? What did you learn in 2007?
Until then, I had no idea that Jeff and Sandy were connected in any way. Okay, I knew that they were in different places when they were shot. So it turns out that that Janice, well, first of all, she has this painting that it turns out that Jeff and Sandy had painted together maybe 2 weeks before the shootings.
Wow.
And, you know, again, I didn't even know that they knew each other. Well, it turns out that they knew each other very well. In fact, they were actually dating one another at that time. And then however many years later, Janice is looking at that painting in her house and realizing that somebody needs to be aware that this painting exists. So she brings it to the attention of Kent State. And it ends up, I think right now, it's in the library at Kent State. I remember one year I was sitting at one of the memorial gatherings on 1 May 4th with Sandy Scheuer's sister, Audrey. And we had both just heard about this at the same time. And we were laughing about how, isn't it crazy that the two of them knew one another and they were actually both in a very happy place at that point in time. And so it is so nice to know that he had met somebody, and who knows where it would have gone. But you know, sometimes I even feel guilty. You know, you lose someone to an illness or a car accident, and it's really just as sad, and you miss the person just as much. But with Jeff, even 50 years later, people still remember. You know, every year somebody comes up to me and says, you know, oh, I just heard, I feel so sorry for you, and that was your brother in the picture? As I said before, I almost feel guilty sometimes because everybody remembers that, and so many people lose family members, and nobody knows.
Oh, well, don't feel guilty, because I'm glad that you're hearing the impact that this photo has on other people. And that brings us to Denise Liddon, who contacted you just after this past anniversary. She is there. And Denise, are you in Cleveland, Ohio?
Just an hour away from Cleveland, Geneva on the Lake, Ohio.
You wrote Russ a letter after this past year's anniversary, just last week, about being on your way home from Cleveland. As a 17-year-old in 1970, you had gone to a concert with a girlfriend. I love this detail. You were both dating guys in the band The Damnation of Adam Blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And you were on your way back, and you got lost. Then what happened?
Well, I was only 17, and we saw this cute kid hitchhiking. You know, back then, pretty much everybody did it. So we picked up this cute kid, and he got in the back seat of my 62 Chevy Biscayne. And we were showing him some photo albums. We always took pictures wherever we went. And so my girlfriend picked up my camera, my girlfriend Patty Hadley Hines, and she took a photo of him sitting in our back seat. That's why he's looking down. He's looking at these photos. And we took him to Kent. He was going to Kent. And so we were happy to take him, knowing our way home from there. And then the shootings happened just after that. And, you know, it was just, it's what everybody was talking about. And it wasn't until after a couple months that it dawned on us that that young man had told us his name was Jeff Miller.
Wow.
And we were like, is that the same guy? But we never really knew for sure. And we had this picture, and many May 4th, I would share it with whoever would be around at the time. But I never knew positively it was him. Always thought in the back of my mind, I should contact someone and see if maybe his mother would like this picture if it's him.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine, he said, Denise, you have got to get a hold of the Kent State Archives. And so I thought, well, let me see for sure if it's him. And immediately they responded and said, yes, it is definitely Jeff Miller. So it may have been his last picture that anyone had taken. His hair was long and he was so sweet, just sitting in the back of the car, just laid back. And so then they contacted Russ.
Russ, I'm looking at this picture.
Well, I'm looking at it now also because I have it framed and I have it in my family room. And when I have breakfast in the morning, I'm facing it.
Oh,
and it is such a great picture because, you know, my dad was a photographer, professional photographer, yet like the classic cliche, you know, you don't have any pictures in a family where your dad's a photographer. But this picture that Denise came up with is exactly who Jeff was. And and it is so comforting and so makes me smile every time I look at it. But that's exactly who he was. And I didn't have any pictures that actually that showed that. How wonderful that here we are 51 years later and something brand new pops up.
It just blesses my heart that it's touched him so gravely because it's just, I never imagined that it would have that kind of, you know, impact and makes me feel so good.
Well, and Russ, this probably is the last photograph ever taken of Jeff.
It is absolutely the last photo, as far as I can tell as well.
Yeah.
Just a young man hitchhiking his way around and enjoying life.
And I've got to meet, I have a new friend. And Denise, I feel like I've found a new friend. So that's also a very good thing.
We are good friends now, Russ. Thank you. Yeah.
Denise Litton, Russ Miller, I want to thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Robin.
I hope to see you, Russ, at the next May 4th dedication.
Well, I'll be there. In fact, you might see me sooner because I have plans to be driving across to Milwaukee in August. And you never know.
That'd be great. I would look forward to that. Bye-bye.
I'm Yoe Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.
This summer, Paris, Berlin, Rome are likely to see American tourists once again. The European Union has agreed to relax COVID-19 travel restrictions, and it looks like the U.S. will make the cut for the safe travel list. Now, we know the EU will allow travelers who have received an approved vaccine. We don't know when the exact date restrictions will be lifted, but great news for tourists, tourism industries, the airlines, and getting them there. Seth Kaplan is here now as a transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
You know, elsewhere in the program, we're going to go to Paris. France opened up internally today, you know, lifting restrictions. But they had a COVID surge just a few weeks ago. So we also don't know what COVID's going to do. But how starved are the tourism, you know, businesses there? How much do they need U.S. travel?
There's no way to overstate the importance in general and also the importance of the timing, Robin, because this is a highly seasonal business in Europe. So, you know, if you wait until, let's say, September, you almost might as well wait until May of the following year, because if you're a tourism business over there, you make your money in June, July, August, the summer travel season. Yeah, people go at other times, but critical for them that Americans are going to have a chance to go there this summer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, briefly, we mentioned all the vaccines approved in the U.S. are going to be accepted by the EU, but they don't, you know, airlines and others run into the same problem restaurants and businesses here have. How do you know? Is it an honor system?
Well, Europe is developing a digital vaccine passport internally there. The U.S. very clearly is not going to have one of those. We have our paper CDC cards. And it seems as though we are somehow going to have to, if we want to travel to Europe, get their passport. So the details aren't yet clear, but it'll probably be something like applying for a visa, Robin, you know, where you just have to go into a system and go ahead and get those credentials to travel within Europe.
Right. So don't disregard that. And one thing else, people who want to travel to the UK were reminded, the UK isn't in the EU. So what's the travel story there?
Yeah, and funny enough, the travel market between the UK and the US opened up sooner than between the UK and Europe. So you could travel from London to New York at one point here recently more easily than you could travel from London to Paris. But similar situation there, just that the details are different. You know, they have their own vaccine verification process, something that you – well, I'm saying you want to make sure of. I should make sure of because I have tickets, Robin, to go to London for a family event if all if all goes well in July. Yeah. So yeah, I'm going to have to make sure to get all that
Better be sure.
on top of the usual
Better be sure. You're welcome. Meanwhile, you know, those airlines that sold you tickets have been on the rebound. They've kept it up. 1.8 million passengers went through TSA checkpoints on Sunday. That's closing the gap with the 2019 figures. So what do you see in terms of summer ticket sales?
Strong demand. In fact, when you look at consumer price inflation, Robin, just kind of the overall numbers in all the different industries, airline tickets jump out as one of the areas that's up the most compared to a year earlier. Rental cars, by the way, up more than almost anything else. There's that shortage that some folks have heard about, and so that's driving prices skyrocketing. But yeah, airline prices are up. That tells you that people are buying those tickets again, even though airlines aren't yet offering as many flights and seats as they did before the pandemic.
Right. And real quick, rehiring pilots, flight attendants, airport staff. This has got to be a boost to the labor market.
Yeah, all good news, no question. Yeah. An industry that took it harder than most and now rebounding.
Seth Kaplan, here now's transportation analyst. We'll keep an eye on whether he gets into the UK. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
House lawmakers are voting today on whether to set up an independent commission to investigate the Capitol insurrection. It gives prominent Republicans like Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy a difficult choice: support the commission and incur the wrath of former President Donald Trump, or try to derail it and risk accusations that they're covering up the deadly violence on January 6th. Well, maybe it doesn't matter because McCarthy has already made up his mind. He said yesterday that he will not support the bipartisan commission, and today his counterpart in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, joined him. Our political strategists join us now. Bill Press is a Democrat and Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hello to you both.
Hi, Peter. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And Alice, I want to start with you because I know that you have come out pretty clearly in our past conversations calling out the insurrectionists and the Republicans who continue to hold up the lie that this election was stolen. Do you think McCarthy and McConnell now are making a mistake here by not supporting the commission?
I think anyone who stands in the way of full transparency and accountability is making a mistake. And what we had at the Capitol on January 6th was just unexcusable. And we need to know many things. We need to know what prompted it, what led people there, the influencing factors. But more than that, also, Peter, we need to know about the security shortfalls. Why was the Capitol Police not prepared for what happened, and how did that come to be? And there are a lot of questions that need to be asked in this case. And I see with a bipartisan commission, half Republicans and half Democrats, we can get a full accounting of exactly what happened. And it's critical. Everyone across the board, Republicans and Democrats, were under attack and threatened on that day. And they all deserve to get answers as to how this happened.
And Alice, one more to you before we move over to Bill. What do you think that McCarthy is really worried about? Is it the wrath of Trump, or is it the fact that he might be subpoenaed to talk about his conversations with the former president on the day of the insurrection? Or maybe it's a little bit of both.
There could be that. But also, I do understand a lot of what they're calling for with regard to let's have investigations and questions about other types of political violence, specifically what happened during the past summer, and asking questions about that. I think that's important. But more so, the attack on our U.S. Capitol, the cornerstone in the heart of our government, that is much of a higher priority. But I understand their concerns about looking at political violence as a whole and asking those questions. And that's really, I think, more of an impetus as to the reservations about getting to the bottom of January 6th. And certainly there could be some concerns about conversations that were had and statements that were made and comments that may or may not have been taken to prevent what happened. But more than anything, they're concerned with across the board look at all political violence.
Okay, and if you're referring to the protests over the summer, of course, those were Those were not intending to overturn a U.S. presidential election. They were not inspired by a president, which is the question that commission is trying to get at. Bill, let's bring you in. Former
Absolutely.
President Trump released a statement last night, and I'm sure you have comments on this, Bill. President Trump is calling this commission a Democrat trap. His words saying Republicans must get tougher and much smarter and stop being used by the radical left. How do you think Democrats should respond to this and to McCarthy and now McConnell's resistance?
I think they should move ahead with this commission, which for all the reasons that Alice stated is so important. It's important to this country. I mean, what happened was such an unbelievable attack on the United States by a group of domestic terrorists. And the idea that we would move on without getting to the bottom of it, without learning the truth and learning how we can better protect the United States Capitol, is just unbelievable that anyone would take that position. So I think they're going to move forward. I think there will be this commission. I was really disappointed in Mitch McConnell. I'm going to say yesterday his position was, okay, let's work on it a little bit. Let's tinker with it. Maybe let's make sure that both sides can hire some staff members. I thought that was the right approach. That was a legitimate reason. Today, to publicly come out against it, I think was a failure of his leadership. The other thing I'd point out, Peter, is for Kevin McCarthy to name one of his top lieutenants, John Katko, and give him the job of making a deal. And Katko got everything he needed in that deal, and he presented it to Kevin McCarthy, and Kevin, we say, throws him under the bus, stabbed him in the back, whatever, is really, I believe, unforgivable. And to your second question, I think it's pretty clear. Two things. McCarthy is Donald Trump's lackey. He cannot help himself. This is a step two in Donald Trump's plan. One, boot Liz Cheney out of power. Two, kill the January 6th commission. And the second reason is McCarthy is deathly afraid of getting a subpoena and having to testify about that call that he made to Donald Trump in the middle of the insurrection. Either way, it's unacceptable. Let the commission go forward. Let the American people know the truth the same way we learned the truth about September 11.
Bill, briefly before we move on to something else, you said you think the commission is going to happen. Really? How is that? I mean, now with McConnell coming out against it, do you really think you have Republicans in the Senate to get on board with this?
I believe there will be enough Republicans in the Senate who will follow the lead of Republican voices like Alice Stewart, like former Congresswoman Barbara Comstock, former Governor Christine Todd Whitman, and a couple of senators already who said, no, this is legitimate. You know, we've got to get to the bottom of this. It will definitely pass the House today, I would hope, with a good number of Republican votes. And I believe there's a good chance. I think it'll be put it this way, Peter. I think it'll be very hard for Republicans to oppose this outright on the floor of the Senate.
Let me go on record as saying I don't believe it will get 60 votes in the Senate, but that's just my anticipation that it won't pass in the Senate. But we shall see.
Well, we'll find out soon. We'll find out soon, and then we'll hopefully talk to those senators, and we'll talk to you again about it. But let's talk about Israel, because Democrats are putting a lot of pressure on the president to react more forcefully against Israel. And today he did. The White House said the president told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he expected a significant de-escalation today on the path to a ceasefire. Alice, I want you to weigh in first. It's been a while since we've heard from you here. What do you think? What do you think of what the president is saying today?
Peter, I could not have been more thrilled to see the tweet today from Barak Ravid that Netanyahu responded to Biden, quote, "I appreciate his support for Israel's right for self-defense." And I think that is something that needs to be said over and over and repeatedly. It's critical that America stands with our ally Israel and against terrorism. And I would wish that President Biden had been a lot more vocal about this from the very beginning, but this is the right stance to take. Having Hamas continue to launch rockets into Israeli population centers is wrong, and they have the right to defend themselves. I was in Israel 2 years ago in a kibbutz along the Gaza Strip. Those people spend 24 hours a day looking for the closest bomb shelter to protect themselves from incoming rockets. That is no way to live, and it's important that we put an end to this violence now.
Bill, what do you think of this pressure campaign from Democrats? Have we ever seen this much support for the Palestinians in Washington?
I think what you're seeing is a support for human rights, and they include Palestinian rights. I was glad to see that that Joe Biden has stepped up the pressure a little bit. I am one of those Democrats who don't think that he's done enough. Look, of course Israel has a right to defend itself. Nobody questions that. Nobody, nobody, nobody. But they also have a responsibility to respect the rights and to protect the rights of the Palestinian people. Remember, so certainly we condemn what Hamas is doing. I also condemn the overreaction of Israel. And I just think it's time for the president to stand up and say, enough is enough. Condemn the violence on both sides and demand a ceasefire. The problem is this helps two people. This helps Bibi Netanyahu, and it helps Hamas. Bibi wants this so he can stay in office, and Hamas wants this so they will be seen, this terrorist group, a totally lawless group, they will be seen as the spokespersons for the Palestinian people, which they are not. So it's a tragedy all the way around. Enough's enough. Just cease fire and get back to talking to each other.
Bill Press is the Democratic strategist. Alice Stewart is our Republican strategist. Always great to speak with you both. Love your insights. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks Peter. Peter. See ya.
A lot of our coverage of the pandemic in the U.S. has been about the efforts to get people vaccinated, the progress cities and states are making in easing restrictions. But let's remind ourselves, more than 587,000 people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19. That number rises every day, and with it, the number of grieving loved ones and friends. The pandemic has been a harsh reminder of our mortality, and it's been an important time for members of an emerging profession whose job it is to help people and their families think about their final days. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck has this story about death doulas.
It was 2018. Chris Bruton was 47. And his dad was dying.
And he actually had stage 4 kidney cancer. He was basically given about 2 to 4 months to live.
When Bruton was a kid, his dad traveled a lot, so we didn't get to know him that well. But after Bruton's mom died, his dad moved in with him in Colorado. A year later, that diagnosis came. Someone Bruton knew suggested a death doula.
And of course, I'd never heard of it. It sounded a little bit hocus-pocusy to me.
And then he met Cindy Kaufman, a doula who runs HeartSpeak End of Life Companioning in Denver. Bruton introduced her to his dad.
And as I walked out, I heard sobbing from my father that I had never heard before. And it just this well of stress and fear, anxiety, sadness, it all just came out.
Kaufman simply asked Bruton's dad how he was doing, truly doing, and he was able to let his defenses down in a way that he couldn't with his family yet.
They're too close to it. I'm not, you know, I'm still an objective bystander in that way.
Kaufman came by one or two times a week and drove down for the end. Even though he'd never heard of a death doula before, Bruton is now a convert.
I had no idea how much work there was to do to help someone who's going through the dying process until I saw what Cindy did. And yeah, changed our lives, changed our lives, and changed my dad's life at the very end of it.
Death doulas are also called death midwives or end-of-life doulas, but whatever you call them, their numbers have blossomed in the last decade. There's a few in every state. Kaufman says they're needed.
End-of-life doulas fill what we believe is a gap.
That gap is the space between hospices, which provide necessary medical care, and what Kaufman does, help someone with the actual process of dying. She adds that since it started in the 70s and 80s, the hospice industry has become more of a business, with certain hours and staff caring for multiple clients. The majority of hospices are now for-profit institutions.
We don't carry those kind of caseloads. We work for ourselves. We don't fall under insurance. We're private pay.
She says death doulas can bring ritual back into dying, make it easier to say goodbye. They can help plan legacy projects, say late night prayers, figure out what to do with your body after you die. For some, they just sit with the dying person right up to the end. Oregon does require a license to earn money consulting with families about funerals or body disposition, but most states don't even do that. And there's no national licensing requirement or mandatory training for death doulas. Some want it to stay that way, so they can help people die in a way that their own background or culture has taught them. Still, several international training centers have cropped up in recent years, some in places like Australia and the UK, and one in New Jersey, the International End-of-Life Doula Association. Henry Fersko Weiss is a death doula who created that organization 6 years ago.
Anybody can call themselves a doula without knowing anything, without having any training.
He says the profession needs standardization in order for its clients to be reimbursed by Medicare or Medicaid. Plus, he says it needs to happen for this fledgling profession to evolve and gain trust. When anyone can do it without any standards, he says,
that can do a disservice to the development of this field.
Deb Rawlings teaches palliative care at Flinders University in Australia. She's one of the few people who've done research on death doulas.
It was amazing to find there were so many differences in what the death doulas say that they do and in what they offer.
She found that many death doulas are former hospice workers or nurses. Some volunteer, others charge, some help with a spiritual journey, others help with more physical tasks. But even though they're so different, they all told her,
we've got time. So I've got time to come in and sit with you. I might sit with the person who's dying and let their family go and have a break. I might help and do the washing.
So they've got time to be with those who are running out of it. For Here and Now, I'm Madeline Beck.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.